Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. Coming up today, Jill Bevilacqua presents There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings and reflections for this third Sunday of Lent. And our regular guest Joan Lewis takes a look behind the scenes at events here in the Vatican over the past 7 days. We begin today's programme then with the Gospel passage for this third Sunday of Lent, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
At that time, some were present who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. He said in reply, "Do you think that these Galileans were the greatest sinners in Galilee just because they suffered this? By no means. But I tell you, you will all come to the same end unless you reform. Or take those 18 who were killed by a falling tower in Siloam. Do you think they were more guilty than anyone else who lived in Jerusalem? Certainly not. But I tell you, you will all come to the same end unless you begin to reform." Jesus spoke this parable. A man had a fig tree growing in his vineyard, and he came out looking for fruit on it, but did not find any. He said to the vine dresser, "Look here. For 3 years now I have come in search of fruit on this fig tree and found none. Cut it down. Why should it clutter up the ground?" In answer, the man said, "Sir, leave it another year while I hoe around it and manure it. Then perhaps it will bear fruit. If not, it shall be cut down."
While the first two Sundays of Lent present the same event recounted in the three-year cycle by Matthew, Mark and Luke, each Gospel for the third Sunday is different. At first sight, today's Gospel is somewhat puzzling. From the temptations in the desert, we were taken to the Transfiguration, and now we're suddenly given what a liturgist described, in inverted commas, as two items from the newspaper, and then a parable about a fig tree. Let the liturgist explain.
In keeping with the instructions of Vatican II, the new liturgy endeavours to make greater use of texts that call for and lead to conversion and penance, especially on the Sundays of Lent. The Gospel gives the Sunday a special theme that is then supported by the other readings, the prayers and the songs.
And referring to the two items from the newspaper, our liturgist tells us that Jesus takes these and makes appropriate comment on them with the words, "Unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." He concludes,
"The accompanying parable of the fruitless fig tree that is given a further chance of survival points in the same direction. The theme of the third Sunday in year C is thus deliverance through conversion."
Well, that's a start. The next thing is, when did Jesus say all this and where was he at that time? In these three Sundays of Lent, we have first the time Jesus spent in the desert, which was apparently in the January of the year 28 AD, The Transfiguration, which we had last week, is said to have taken place in the July or August of 29, and today's episode is dated between January and February of the year 30, which means only a few more months before our Lord's Passion and Death. Jesus had been in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication, Hanukkah, Feast of Lights, which took place in December, and on that occasion he solemnly affirmed his divinity. The Jews took up stones to stone him, we read in the Gospel of John, and they tried to arrest him. But, writes John, he escaped from their hands. His time is near, but not imminent. And so Jesus leaves Jerusalem and withdraws to the other side of the Jordan, to stay in the district where John had once been baptizing, writes John the Evangelist. Bethany beyond Jordan. Perea, the territory of Herod. While he was in that area, some Pharisees came to warn Jesus that Herod wanted to kill him, writes one scholar.
After having beheaded John the Baptist, Herod was afraid of a popular rising in favour of Jesus, but Jesus did not fear him, for he knew that his time had not yet come and that his end was to be at Jerusalem.
And so Jesus moves northward along the eastern banks of the Jordan, through towns and villages teaching, writes Luke. And during this time, some of his listeners tell him how once Pontius Pilate had mixed the blood of some Galileans with their sacrifices. Luke doesn't enlighten us as to the facts of this episode, going on immediately to our Lord's answer. But if we look at a note in the Illustrated Gospel, we find some information.
During the Jewish festivals, Pilate was always present in Jerusalem for fear of disturbances caused by the overcrowding in the city. From this reference, it would seem that some Galileans, while offering sacrifice in the temple, had somehow incurred Pilate's suspicion and that he had intervened rather harshly and had some of them killed.
To say that Pilate intervened rather harshly is perhaps making light of an incident which is even referred to in a recent edition of the Cambridge Encyclopedia. Although it doesn't mention the bloodshed, it reports what provoked it. He caused unrest by his use of temple funds to build an aqueduct. An aqueduct. Those magnificent feats of Roman engineering which are still visible today. Years ago, when I was working in the casting office during the filming of Cleopatra, the company cars used to pick up the staff in the centre of Rome and then drive us out to the studios of Cinecittà, which look south to the Alban Hills. And always as we sped along the new Appian Way, which runs close to the ancient Regina Viarum, or Queen of Roads, as the poet Statius called it, and which St. Peter himself walked when fleeing from Rome, according to the legend of Quo Vadis, and Paul and Luke and their companions on their arrival in Rome, always as we sped along we would look out over the fields at the graceful arches of the aqueduct of the Emperor Claudius, rising out of the meadows, in May brilliant with poppies. And these days, when I go out of town to look after my daughter's little ones, I take a train which passes the Vatican radio site of Santa Maria di Galleria. And there, once again, so close to the radio masts, the ancient technology survives, in another aqueduct, sunk deep in grassy fields. Whether they be Greek temples or Roman aqueducts, there's something about ancient ruins that survive today surrounded by flowers of the field, that possess a beauty their makers could never have dreamed of. A meeting of nature and art, of God and man. And Pilate's aqueduct? Who but our faithful companion H.V. Morton can better tell the story? He was on the way to Bethlehem, probably on that main road known as the Way of the Patriarchs.
Just where the road branches off to Hebron, I looked over a stone wall and saw something which an archaeologist in Jerusalem had told me not to miss. The only surviving relic of Pontius Pilate. It's the ruin of an aqueduct which ran from the pools of Solomon to the temple area. It was an engineering work which involved Pilate in a financial scandal. In order to bring water from Solomon's pools to the temple, although his enemies said that the water was rarely intended for military purposes in the event of an insurrection, Pilate raided the enormous funds known as the Korban, lying in the temple treasury. The appropriation of this money created violent opposition. The storm broke when Pilate came up to Jerusalem from his headquarters at Caesarea, probably during the annual Passover pilgrimage, when he was always present with extra troops in case of trouble. This time, Pilate sent troops disguised as Jewish pilgrims among the crowds. These troops, at a signal, attacked the Jews and quelled the disturbance. If this episode occurred at Passover time, there seems to be an echo of it in St. Luke, who mentions the Galileans whose blood Pilate mingled with their sacrifices.
I don't know whether there's anything left of Pilate's aqueduct today. It's not mentioned in the guidebook. But let's hear what our traveller found that day back in the 1930s.
I climbed over the wall and inspected this extraordinary relic. Few people know that it exists, and unless someone takes care of it, the remaining water pipes, or rather stones, will be carried away and used for building material. In fact, the head of the Magi's well further back along the Jerusalem road is one of these stones. The aqueduct runs at the edge of the boundary wall and disappears from sight beneath a house. It's formed of huge blocks of stone with a central hole drilled in them, and so arranged that each stone fitted with a neck firmly into the next, making a solid rock channel for the water.
The Magi's well is sometimes called the Well of the Star, for the legend runs that on their way to Bethlehem, the wise men lost the star. But stopping at this well to slake their thirst, they found it again shining in the water. Another name is Mary's Well, for the story goes that when the Holy Family were travelling between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, they rested at the well and drank its waters. Well, you pay your money and you take your choice, as they say. And before we move on to the second incident mentioned in our Gospel, an interesting theory is thrown up by H.V. Morton. The Galileans Pilate slaughtered were not subject to him, but to Herod Antipas. Now, when Pilate handed Jesus the Galilean over to Herod, Morton reminds us, we learn from St. Luke that the same day Herod and Pilate were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves. And Morton concludes.
If it is possible that Pilate sent Jesus as a peace offering to the ruler of Galilee in return for the Galileans he had attacked on a previous occasion, then the strange thought occurs that the building of this aqueduct, the cause of the original enmity between Pilate and Herod, was a contributory factor in the crucifixion of Jesus. If the theory I've advanced is reasonable, this line of stones is one of the strangest and most significant relics in the world.
Why did those people listening to Jesus recount the story of Pilate and the Galileans? A Bible scholar comments.
The way in which this incident was reported to Jesus reveals the opinion usual at that time, which supposed that every misfortune was God's punishment, summarily inflicted for the sins of those who experienced it.
Even today, when referring to some unpleasant duty, you may hear someone remark, usually with a toss of the head or shrug of the shoulders, "Oh well, I suppose I'll have to do it for my sins." Jesus knew very well what the speakers meant and refuted their interpretation of the incident. To make his point, he reminded them of another occasion when a falling tower killed 18 people. Writes a scholar,
"It seems that this refers to workmen who were employed around the Tower of Siloam, which for some reason unknown to us, collapsed on them and killed 18.
This sort of tragedy is only too familiar, for it still occurs today when men are working on a building, either in construction or for maintenance, and this despite modern procedures of hard hats and other safety precautions. Throughout the centuries, men have built towers and are still building them. Many have become celebrated, such as the Tower of Babel, which was intended to reach heaven, but became a symbol of confusion after God scattered the builders and confused language. The Bastille, wrote Lawrence Stern, is but another word for a tower. The Tower of London, which started off as a fortress, was later a royal residence, and today is mainly for tourists who queue up to see the crown jewels. But it has a grimmer history as a state prison in which many of the famous were confined and left only on their way to execution, among them St. Thomas More, St. John Fisher, and many other martyrs. There are other well-known towers, such as the Leaning Tower of Pisa and Giotto's Tower, which Longfellow called the Lily of Florence blossoming in stone. And other so-called Towers of Silence, small circular stone structures on which the Parsis and Zoroastrians place their dead so that the flesh can be stripped by vultures. The bones, dried by the sun, are then thrown into a receptacle covered with charcoal. And no need to do more than mention the most tragic of modern towers, which have given a date in September a sad notoriety it can never be free of. But what about the tower that fell on the workmen of Siloam? It was clearly not what Tennyson wrote of the Duke of Wellington, that tower of strength which stood four square to all the winds that blew. In my illustrated Bible, there's a photograph showing a circle of stones and described as the round base of a tower at Siloam. It doesn't give any more details. Siloam is outside the city walls of Jerusalem, on the southwestern corner of the city of David, the oldest inhabited part of Jerusalem. And the name Siloam probably reminds us of the occasion when Jesus restored the sight of a blind man. After making clay with his spittle and spreading it on the man's eyes, he told him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. The water of the pool, believed to be a spring, was considered pure and was used in temple ceremonies, and was also thought to have curative qualities. But the facts are different. A Bible expert suggests that the tower that collapsed might have been a fortification of the city walls, near the channel that brought the water from the Gihon spring to the pool of Siloam. The Gihon Spring, or Virgin's Fountain, which rises in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, is the only perennial spring in the whole area, and the reason why David built his city near it. 700 years before Christ, Jerusalem was under siege by the Assyrians. King Hezekiah built a massive wall and then cut a 1750-foot tunnel under the old city of David to bring the spring into the city. He then sealed up the spring and hid it from the advancing army. By our Lord's time, however, Hezekiah's tunnel had become silted up and forgotten. But as the water of the spring continued to seep into the pool, it was thought to be a natural spring. Perhaps that's why in an early 19th century hymn we have these lines: "By cool Siloam's shady rill, how sweet the lily grows," which make it sound much more like a stream. In the early 20th century, two boys playing in the valley discovered the tunnel and managed to crawl through it. So it was cleaned, and today tourists in plastic sandals walk through it. In the 1930s, it was, wrote H.V. Morton, wet, messy and dangerous, and you have to explore it at night in order not to stir up the water of the Virgin's Fountain, in which the women of Siloam wash their clothes during the daytime. But it must have been worth the effort, for he noted that the marks made by the axes of the workmen of King Hezekiah were sharp and clear on the stone. And today, the tunnel still carries water from the spring to the pool. As for Hezekiah, he's even mentioned in a children's book about animals, birds and plants of the Bible. And it brings us to the last part of our gospel, the parable of the fruitless fig tree.
In a hot country like Palestine, any tree which gives shade is welcome. The fig tree, which can grow to a height of over 30 feet, is valued for its leafy foliage as well as for its fruit, which it bears for 10 months of the year. In the first book of Kings, we read that every man dwelt safely under his own vine and under his own fig tree. The fruit was eaten fresh or dried and pressed together into cakes to store for winter. King David gave a piece of fig cake to an exhausted Egyptian soldier fallen in battle. 200 cakes of figs were part of a peace offering which David had given to him for his men by Abigail. The gift was so big that it was carried on the backs of donkeys. Figs were used for medicinal purposes too, and Hezekiah was cured of a boil by the application of a poultice of figs.
Not perhaps the way a king would wish to be remembered, but Hezekiah's fame is secure. He may not have built an aqueduct, but he dug a tunnel.
And you can join Sean Patrick Lovett and Jill Bevilacqua at this same time next week for another edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now our regular guest Joan Lewis is back to take a look behind the scenes at events here in the Vatican over the past 7 days. So, Joan, welcome back. Lovely to have you with us. You've been on a fabulous trip, haven't you, just briefly to Beirut and Iraq?
I spent 8 full days in northern Iraq doing reportage on the situation of Christians, in particular Catholics. I was invited by the Chaldean bishops and stayed at a Chaldean seminary there, a very, very beautiful place, and toured 5 dioceses. We did 1,000 kilometers in 3 days on a 3-day long weekend. And the reality that is Iraq and Lebanon, actually, too, when I did end up spending 5 days there, the reality is like this kaleidoscope of all the different colors. It's colorful, but yet you turn the kaleidoscope and everything gets all mixed up and confused and complex and complicated and ever-changing. The different religions, when you talk to people, you have to find out where they're coming from to understand their answer to your question. So you say, are you Christian or Muslim? If you're Muslim, are you Sunni or Shia? Are you Arab or Kurd? And anybody who's been following even remotely the history, obviously, of the last 10, 15, 20 years of Iraq knows that these are fundamental questions in people in the, obviously, the politics of the land. Christians are being killed, especially in the south in Baghdad and south of Baghdad and in Mosul, because there is, first of all, Christians are associated with the West. They're associated with Western Europe, with the United States, even with the Vatican. So those who want to rid Iraq of Christians, they see them as an enemy, even though, of course, they just want to be good citizens, own their home, send their kids to school, be like anybody else. So it's very, very complex, very volatile, too.
All of this was very much on Pope Benedict's mind,
wasn't it,
as he made that dramatic appeal at the Angelus on Sunday for Christians in Iraq.
He did indeed. He said how pained he was to have learned of the killings. I think it was eight Christians in Mosul alone. And I did meet and spend some time with the new bishop of Mosul, not in the city of Mosul, but in his diocese. So the Pope said he was very much aware of the violence of the killings. He deplored that. And, you know, he knows that Christians are a minority. He said he has in the past, and with the Angelus, urged the government to protect minorities. And he said he's very much aware of the fact that elections, March 7th elections, are the cause on the part of some for an excess of violence and for the killings of Christians. So he asked for, as a pope always will in a situation of conflict, he just asked for dialogue. Bring all your ideas to the table. Protect the human rights of all people, minority and majority. And speaking of protection, the pope also moved to another huge topic, and that is to say Chile, which had that massive 8.8 earthquake. He said, obviously, the Chileans are in his thoughts and prayers. He's close to all those who have suffered in any way or certainly have died. He urged the international community, obviously, as, again, popes do in this type of a situation, urged the international community to come to the aid, you know, bring assistance. Sure. And Caritas, speaking of the Catholic Church, is always right there. And the more I've learned about it, I saw Caritas in action in Lebanon as they take care of Lebanon being one of the Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, the transit countries for people who flee, for example, from Iraq and generally try to resettle in the U.S. or Australia. So Caritas, very, very hard at work, to be commended with every word of thanks possible.
Moving on to some other news from the Vatican this week, we've heard about another trip coming up in the not-too-distant future, the Pope due to head to Spain in November.
Yes, kind of a little surprise. We had heard of the invitation probably about 2 weeks before. This was actually announced by the Vatican this week, but the Pope will only be 2 days, but he will go to Santiago de Compostela, and our listeners who know Spanish know that Santiago refers to St. James and St. James the Greater. And I'm sure everyone knows, maybe they've even gone on the pilgrimage. And apparently you're supposed to like walk the last 100 miles
most popular pilgrimages, isn't it, anywhere in the world, I believe.
It is indeed. And I know that Santiago is a World Heritage City. And so the Pope will spend 1 day there, November 6th, and then November 7th he will go to Barcelona to inaugurate a church that has been in the building since 1882. It is not expected to be completed until 2026. The architect, Antonio Gaudi, is, as a matter of fact, his cause for beatification is underway. But this is apparently a privately funded church, and part of it is expected to be open to the public, tours and things like that, in September of this year. So apparently we'll be ready for the Pope when he goes there in November. But ought to be a very interesting trip, only 2 days, but you know, he's going to do two big things. Of course, he'll be back in Spain in 2011 for World Youth Day in Madrid. So this will give him a little...
Just getting a foretaste of what it's going to be like.
My precise words, exactly.
Looking at some other things, not directly papal activities, but some other important meetings here in the Vatican this week. There was a big meeting organized by the Pontifical Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, looking particularly at the plight and the need for pastoral care concerning gypsies, traveling peoples. It was an interesting meeting, wasn't it?
Exactly. The main thing is, I don't know how many of our listeners are in countries that have a gypsy population. Italy has one. We see them all over Rome. They do face tremendous discrimination. Every so often we read in the papers here, obviously, of a gypsy camp being, you know, forced to close because of the conditions they live in. And that was one of the things highlighted in this meeting. The Vatican officials, of course, said that the situation situation of the Gypsy peoples in Europe is strongly marked by marginalization and discrimination, even in their exercise of fundamental human rights, like the right to education, work, housing, and health care. Interestingly enough, there was a comment in one article I did read about this, that to give a wider public a knowledge of the Gypsy culture, the Vatican's invited a Hungarian Gypsy orchestra to perform in Rome during this period. And also on Wednesday, March 3rd, the national Gypsy soccer team played a friendly match against the Swiss Guard team. So, and one of the statistics that came out of this meeting was the fact that there are 36 million Rom in, that's one of the names, they're called Rom, Sinti, Manouche, Kale. So about 36, I think I said Europe, there are 36 million around the world. So we shall see if in the long run the council comes out with a document, what the effect of this might be. And if we didn't say it, the meeting was for all the directors in Europe who handle, among other things, the pastoral ministry of gypsies, and as you said, of people on the move. So a very interesting meeting indeed.
Meanwhile, the head of the Vatican's Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent, has been busy this week. He was over in Egypt, in Cairo, for the annual meeting with the Al-Azhar University there, the regular annual dialogue meeting that takes place. And some interesting subjects for discussion there, weren't there, at that encounter?
Actually, I think the Cardinal has gotten a few frequent flyer miles because he was in Granada, Spain, in February for a several-day meeting, and it was a congress sponsored by the Faculty of Theology of Granada entitled Christianity, Islam, and Modernity. And as we air this show, he is in the United States. Another similar vein conference is being held at, I believe it is, the National Cathedral in Washington. But what you mentioned was the later February meeting, and the title's rather long, but it really does focus on the entire theme of what they studied, the phenomenon of confessional violence, understanding the phenomenon and its causes, and proposing solutions with particular reference to the role of religions in the field. So you had the Holy See represented, obviously you had the head of Al-Azhar University in Cairo. It's very interesting, the document that came out, the participants agreed to pay greater attention to the fact that the manipulation of religion for political or other ends can be a source of violence. And then these same leaders, again, Catholic and Muslim, agreed to oppose with determination any act that tends to create tension, division, and conflict in societies. And lastly, and I kind of thought this was rather interesting, the Muslim and Catholic leaders called for steps to be taken to ensure that the preaching of religious leaders, as well as school education and textbooks, do not contain declarations or references to historical events that directly or indirectly may arouse violent reactions among the followers of the different religions, as can happen so often when you have history revisited by someone who is either giving a speech or is writing a text that will eventually become part of a classroom curriculum.
Thank you very much, Jane. We look forward to seeing you at the same time next week.
You will indeed.
Bye-bye. Thanks there to our regular guest, Joan Lewis, bringing us up to date on all that's been happening here in the Vatican over the past 7 days. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.